Good morning. It is a privilege to be able to appear before the court at Battle Mountain High School. Because this case involves a matter of first impression under Colorado law, it is particularly appropriate for selection for the courts in the community program. This morning, I would like to discuss the two issues that were raised in this appeal. The first is the statutory interpretation of the term solicitation under the Fair Campaign Practices Act. The second issue I would like to discuss is the attorney fee award entered by the administrative law judge against the plaintiff in the proceedings below, Mr. Thomas Cave, and his counsel, Ms. Jessica Peck, whom I am here representing today. Turning first to the statutory interpretation, the statute in question is the Fair Campaign Practices Act, which regulates solicitation of contributions to political campaigns by professional lobbyists. The facts in this case are simple and undisputed. In February 2012, while the Colorado General Assembly was in session, Ann Guihan, the defendant in the case below, was a professional lobbyist who agreed to list her name as a co-host on an invitation to a fundraising event in support of a candidate for the General Assembly.
Ms. Timmons, excuse me, I have a question about the record on the fundraising event.
Yes.
Where in the hearing was it established that the event in question was actually a fundraiser in nature?
We are relying on the findings of fact that were made by the administrative law judge. He made 17 separate findings of fact. And there's three findings that together indicate that this was a fundraiser. Finding number four states that there was an email for a Diane Primavera fundraiser. That is in finding of fact number four. Finding of fact number six is that the respondent's name was used with her permission on the invitation. And finding of fact number 10 states that on the invitation, the respondent, Ms. McGeehan, is identified as a host and a member of the host committee, and it goes on to provide host $250, co-host $175, friend $100, and there were amounts listed.
Okay, I guess the question I have is that the record does establish an email for a fundraiser, and then there is also an invitation for an event. And I'm not sure the event is the equivalent of fundraiser. I believe that the ALJ made a finding that the record doesn't establish whether those, the email, the fundraiser, and the event were actually the same.
Well, again, I would just refer the court to the findings of fact, which is what we are basing our appeal on. And in finding of fact number 10, the administrative law judge does refer to the invitation. On the invitation, the respondent is identified as a host, and then it provides on the invitation that there would be dollar amounts for different participants in the fundraiser, including anywhere from $250 to $50. And so the invitation is referred to above in finding effect number six. Does that answer your question?
Well, more or less, the other question I have is the finding of fact 10 appears to be under the category request for attorney's fees. And in your view, does that make any difference?
No, it does not make any difference. Headings are not indicative. In this case, there were 17, and the numbers continue consecutively. There were 17 different findings of fact. And if this is a finding of fact for purposes of one issue on the case, it is a finding of fact for purposes of the case. And in fact, it's all the more reason that because the administrative law judge made this finding, it's all the more reason that this complaint did state a claim and did not warrant an award of attorney's fees in this case.
Counsel, how do we reconcile what you're claiming here, that the content of the invitation is part of the record, with the trial judge's observation that the invitation was not admitted into evidence, the blog was not admitted into evidence? how do we reconcile that?
Well, in this case, what was available at trial was a photocopy, and the original was not available. And in that instance, testimony was offered at the hearing, including testimony of the defendant, Ms. McGeehan, herself. And it was based on that testimony that the administrative law judge made these findings.
When the fundraiser email, and I'm kind of following up on Judge Fox's question here, when the email and the invitation were not admitted into evidence, I'm wondering how the ALJ could make a finding that the two documents were concerning the same event. Are you saying that you're relying on the testimony of the defendant?
Yes, exactly.
To make that connection without the documents having been admitted into evidence?
Yes, I believe that the administrative law judge relied on the testimony at trial to make these findings of fact. And if you look at the findings of fact, it was clear that he saw that there was an invitation to a fundraising event and that Ms. McGeehan had agreed to put her name on the fundraising invitation. And that is finding of fact number 6. The respondent's name was used with her permission on the invitation. And this was all based on testimony that was at the trial.
Well, even with the testimony, though, Ms. Peck was having a difficult time getting any answers established on the record. For example, in one portion of the hearing, Ms. Peck asked if Ms. McGeehan was aware of an email invitation that was sent out, and Ms. McGeehan was aware that there was an email concerning a fundraiser. But then when she does the follow-up question, are you aware that your name appeared on the invitation? Ms. McGeehan said, I don't know which email you're talking about, and then changed the subject, and Ms. Peck never came back and pinned her down on that answer. There's just no testimony that was elicited.
Well, I don't have the record in front of me at this moment, but I do know what the administrative law judge found as part of his findings of fact. And he did make a finding that Ms. McGeehan's name was used with her permission on the invitation, and that there was a fundraiser for Diane Primavera. And these were part of the findings of fact in this case.
Well, those findings have to be supported by the record, do they not?
Well, I believe they are. I believe that they are supported by the testimony, that even if there was conflicting testimony, the judge, the ALJ, used his discretion to determine the most credible testimony based on what he saw that morning. And so the conclusion is that he made these findings based on the testimony, the other evidence that was there that day, and that although there may have been times where the testimony was conflicting, I believe that he made these findings based on what he thought was the most credible testimony that was presented that morning. So I would like to just turn to whether the placing of one's name as a co-host on an invitation would constitute solicitation or even a promise to solicit under the Fair Campaign Practices Act. And of course, that is the issue for the court to determine today. The ALJ determined that it did not constitute solicitation, and based on that conclusion, he dismissed the complaint for failure to state a claim. We believe that conclusion is incorrect, and therefore that decision should be reversed. To interpret the statute, the court can first look to the plain language of the statute itself, which not only prohibits solicitation, but also promises to solicit. More importantly, the court can look to a subsequent provision in the same statute, and that provision defines certain permissible and impermissible conduct of a lobbyist. And I would like to refer the court to section 105.5 subsection 1C, and this is directly below subsection 1A, which creates the violation. Subsection 1C defines certain permissible and impermissible conduct, and I do have a copy of that if it would be helpful. But that section provides that a lobbyist is not permitted is not prohibited, I'm sorry, a lobbyist is not prohibited from participating in a fundraising event of a political party, so long as, and this is the key language in subsection 1C, so long as the purpose of the event is not to raise money for a specifically designated candidate for the General Assembly. So, because in this section 1C, the legislature specifically said that it is okay for a lobbyist to participate in fundraising events on behalf of a political party, but that it is not okay to participate in fundraising activity on behalf of a particular candidate, it is clear that the statute does not permit fundraising activity by lobbyists on behalf of specific candidates.
What effect, if any, it was Ms. McGee, is it McGeehan?
Yes.
How do you pronounce it? Withdrawal of her name from the invitation, and it seems like the record indicated that fairly soon after this invitation went out, she withdrew her name.
Well, I think what we can conclude, first of all, going back to the findings of fact, it's clear that this was an email invitation, and so by definition, when it was an email, it had already been on the internet. So to withdraw your name after it had already been sent out as an email, I believe the name was not withdrawn before the invitation was sent out by virtue of the fact that it was by email. But more importantly, the fact that it was withdrawn, it still shows a promise to solicit a contribution on behalf of a candidate. So even if the invitation had not been sent by email, and of course the finding is that it was an email and therefore it was sent out, but even if it had not been sent out, the fact that a person was willing to put their name on the invitation in the first place and then only withdrew it because they were held to the law and challenged, that nevertheless constitutes a promise to solicit a contribution, a promise to the candidate. And in fact, if it weren't considered a promise or some sort of violation under the statute, it would permit a candidate, a lobbyist, to go ahead and place the name on an invitation and wait to be challenged prior to withdrawing the name. I think also it's important in interpreting this statute to look to the purposes behind the legislature's enactment of the statute in the first place. In the legislative declaration, which is contained in 102 of the Act itself, the legislature recognized that large contributions to political candidates create the potential for corruption. In addition, large campaign contributions allow wealthy contributors and special interest groups to exercise undue influence over the political process. And it was with these interests in mind that the legislature decided to prohibit solicitation of contributions.
Ms. Timmons, sorry for interrupting you, but I just want to remind you, you have about a minute and 20 seconds left wanted to reserve anything for rebuttal.
Actually, I would like to just simply discuss the second issue on this appeal, which is the attorney fee award and the groundlessness and frivolousness of the complaint. And with respect to the frivolousness, I would say that the claims, both claim one and claim two in the complaint, were based on the Fair Campaign Practices Act and the fact that the administrative law judge made an interpretation of the act with which we do not agree. Nevertheless, the parties in this, Mr. Cave had raised a novel issue in an area of law that was unsettled, and under established Colorado authority, an award of attorney fees under those circumstances would be an abuse of the court's discretion. And with respect to the groundlessness, I would like to point again to the agency decision, which contains 17 separate findings of fact, including facts that support both claims. With respect to claim two, there was an additional invitation that was available to be submitted for, as evidence, but was not because claim two was voluntarily dismissed. And under this court's decision in Harrison versus Smith, 821 P. 2nd, 832, that invitation should also be considered in making a finding of groundlessness. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Gruskin. I'm counsel to Ann McGeehan, who sits with me at counsel table. This is a matter of campaign finance enforcement. And the system in Colorado, as the court knows, is brought solely by citizen complaint. But the safety valve in that system is to ensure that people like Ms. McGeehan aren't unfairly and unduly charged when there's no evidence to support a complaint. And because the statute, campaign finance statute, anticipates the award of attorney's fees where a complaint is either frivolous or groundless, it is appropriate to uphold the ALJ's decision in this matter. This is a claim that Ms. McGeehan violated Colorado Revised Statutes 1-45-105.5 in two different ways. First of all, by soliciting or promising to solicit contributions for a candidate, and secondly, by soliciting or promising to solicit contributions for a political party. That second claim, no evidence was ever even attempted to be brought. And in that regard, the administrative law judge found that his decision that attorney fees were warranted was clear cut, in his words. What did Mr. Cave present? He presented evidence that Diana Primavera was a candidate in 2012. Secondly, he presented evidence that Ms. McGeehan was, in fact, a lobbyist in 2012. And thirdly, he presented an exhibit showing that the Colorado General Assembly was in session at that time. What he tried to prove and failed to prove was that Ms. McGeehan solicited or agreed to solicit contributions, and then he also said that she admitted that she'd made a mistake in doing so.
Counsel, how do you respond to Ms. Timmons' argument that the record substantiates that the event was a fundraiser and that Ms. McGeehan was soliciting money for a candidate?
I think there are two questions that you're asking me, Your Honor.
Sure.
The first question is the whole issue of, is the email also the invitation? And in that regard, the ALJ's finding is binding. They weren't ever proven to be the same document. But the more pressing question that you point to is whether or not she was soliciting contributions by lending her name to a document. The answer to that question lies in a document that is not before the court. It was not before the administrative law judge. And as the court knows, unless it was admitted as an exhibit at trial, you cannot consider it. And to the extent that it was not admitted at trial, no one has established what that document said. And to the extent that we don't know what those words are all critical in the law. We don't know what those words as used were. And therefore, it cannot be said that those words comprised a solicitation. And to that end, the failure to prove that that invitation existed could have been counterbalanced. Had Mr. Cave shown that Ms. McGeehan approached her friends, that she talked to Ms. Primavera, that she lent Ms. Primavera an email list, that she actually went to the event herself, that she made telephone calls, had he proved anything, he didn't have to just prove that the invitation existed. And what he did was particularly problematic because this complaint was brought on March 1st. The hearing was held 7 months later. And as the court knows, there are an array of tools available to lawyers to try and develop evidence. You have discovery. You can take depositions. You can find out what people are thinking. You can ask for admissions. And what did Mr. Cave do in order to buttress his case? Not a thing. Not one thing. He never asked for a deposition of Ms. Primavera or her campaign so that he could establish what the invitation said or what Ms. McGeehan did or anything else. And under the case law from this court, which we cited in our brief, that failure to do a pre-trial investigation and then come to trial without being able to adduce adequate evidence, even to get beyond a motion to dismiss at the middle of trial, suggests strongly that the party having done that is liable for attorney's fees.
Well, Mr. Griskin, didn't Ms. McGeehan herself testify about lending her name to the invitation, even though the invitation itself was not in evidence? We have some testimony by Ms. McGeehan.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And why is that not sufficient in this case?
Well, it is not sufficient in this case for two different reasons. First of all, the invitation itself was never presented, and there was no testimony by Ms. McGeehan as to what the invitation said. But it is important that the record points out that the actual document that was presented to Ms. McGeehan was one that she thought contained typographical errors that she did not recognize. And she was, in fact, comparing two documents, neither of which were the actual invitation. One was appended to the original complaint, and one was this conservative blog posting that the judge even struck all the political innuendo that led into it because he found it so problematic. So there was no credibility associated with the single document that was offered at trial. And Ms. McGeehan was never asked, what did the invitation say? She didn't recall at that point. It had been 7 months. It was the obligation of Mr. Cave to come up with that document, either from Ms. Primavera or otherwise. And it's important to note that Mr. Coleman, who testifies for Mr. Cave, says, I got several emails with this invitation. Does he produce any of the emails that he says he got? No. They use a blog posting instead. But what he does say is that he doesn't know any of the people who sent him that blog posting. He doesn't know anyone associated with the blog itself. He doesn't know how that language actually was placed on this political blog. And when asked, have you compared it word for word to know whether or not the document appended to the complaint is the same as the blog posting, he said, no, I haven't. We also asked, did you get an invitation as a potential recipient? So he could have testified about the original just through testimony, forget using the actual document. And he said, no, I didn't get the actual document. So there was no evidence that we should have been at hearing. And remember, the procedural status of this case was that originally the ALJ issued an inquiry to the complainant saying, do you really have jurisdiction to be before me here? And the answer was, at least preliminarily, by the ALJ, I will hear this case. We filed a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-5, saying that this really wasn't a case that could be heard by the ALJ. And Mr. Cave said, it absolutely is. This is a blatant violation. At that point, Mr. Cave could have assessed his evidence in July, over 4 months after the complaint was filed, and said, you know what? We shouldn't be in front of this court. But he didn't. He said, we absolutely deserve a full hearing. And at a full hearing, it's the obligation of a complainant to produce the evidence.
Mr. Griskin, could you address whether it's appropriate to look at the finding number 10 in connection with attorney's fees as far as the merits finding?
The finding number 10 relates to the judge's observation about the document that was included in the blog posting. Am I correct, Your Honor?
I believe that's right. It's the one that lists the co-host amounts.
Right. So I don't misanswer your question. Let me just take a look at the decision. Yes, that is the one. It seems to me that once the court ruled that an exhibit was inadmissible, there was no cause to consider it even as to attorney's fees. But the complainant doesn't argue that that was reversible error before this court. As a matter of fact, there are several arguments that were made this morning that weren't raised in the briefs. I think that the goal of the judge was simply to say, in finding number 10, Even I can't tell from looking at something that has been presented to me whether or not this was an invitation that really conditioned participation or attendance on paying a certain amount of money. What the judge points to in paragraph 10 is that a contribution is suggested. And he said, I don't know whether that applies to the $50 level or all the levels. And so I think the only reason he was pointing to the document that he refused to admit because it wasn't credible and it wasn't reliable was to say that even giving Mr. Cave the benefit of the doubt, this is not a document that would have made a case for solicitation. And so I think in order to assure this court on appeal, the ALJ made that particular decision. Now, there was also a newspaper article, as the court has read, but this is an article that was clearly hearsay. It was an out-of-state, out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted. But then, when Mr. Kay's attorney called Ms. McGeehan, she said, I didn't make that statement. And so the judge properly excluded the newspaper article, too. Now, much of this comes down to the definition of what does it mean to solicit a donation.
Counsel, do we even need to get to the matter of what solicitation means if we conclude that the contents of this invitation that everybody kept talking about, but nobody introduced the contents of it, do we need to get there?
I don't think you do, Your Honor.
You may continue.
And obviously, the predicate legal issue is whether or not there was even evidence of some act. But there is a Colorado definition from this court in the 2001 case of Atmel Corporation versus the Test Semiconductor Corporation. And while Mr. Cave's reply brief suggests that we are relying only upon a dictionary definition. In fact, we're relying upon this court's definition that looked at a dictionary definition and said you actually have to approach with a request or plea, which goes very much to your point, Judge Fox. Has there been anything that resembles a request or plea? And based upon the record, what's actually in the record, no one can say that that is in fact the case. One important point. And we alluded to this in our answer brief. One of the key cases that's relied upon is the case from Connecticut, the Green Party of Connecticut case versus Garfield. Mr. Cave has misstated the law in connection with that case. That case specifically said that it is a violation of the First Amendment to take solicitation bans and apply them to lobbyists to keep them from soliciting funds as a blanket matter. And so it is important to note that there are at least some legal misstatements, but there are also some technical misstatements that the court needs to know about before it renders a decision first. On page 9 of the reply brief, Cave suggests that, and states, McGeehan, quote, McGeehan herself admitted that her activity constitutes a, quote, technical violation of the FCPA, pointing to, she says the opening brief, but I assume she meant the answer brief at pages 8 and 9. No such language exists in our brief. There's never been an admission of that sort. And I would point the court as well to the record on page 000272, paragraph 12, where the ALJ had an exact replica of that issue, where Cave asserted that there had been an admission of a violation. And the judge said at hearing there was no such admission. In addition, on page 11 of the reply brief, Mr. Cave quotes or purports to quote the finding of fact number 6 and quotes it in the following way. Quote, defendant McGeehan agreed to co-host a fundraiser for Canada Primavera and thereby agreed to be named as a co-host on the invitation to the fundraiser event, end quote, and cites the record. But in fact, what finding of fact 6 says is something different, very different. And it says the respondent's name was used with her permission on the invitation. She later asked for her name to be removed from the invitation. So there are substantive, and I would argue to the court, material misstatements of fact that go to the very nature of what this case is about. So let's talk about attorney's fees. Why is it important?
Counsel, before you proceed with your argument on attorney's fees, I would like you to address how we reconcile the ALJ's finding that claim one, and I'm just talking about claim one, was substantially frivolous, vexatious, and groundless, when at the attorney's fees hearing, you stipulated on the record that claim one wasn't frivolous.
And I was getting to that right here, Your Honor. It seems to me that the judge used a broad label, and to the extent that our brief suggests anything other than what we said at hearing, which is the argument for attorney's fees is not about frivolousness. It is about groundlessness. It is about a lack of facts. It's not about a conceptual or theoretical legal theory.
So you concede that the complaint could have stated a claim?
Correct, Your Honor. We certainly do. And I appreciate you getting to that, because that was the next point in my outline. At trial, the parties have to have sufficient evidence to support their claims. They have all sorts of discovery tools and opportunities to get there. Mr. Cade did not use any of them. But on appeal, a frivolous claim lacks substantial justification. This court has said, and the Supreme Court has said, lacking substantial justification includes lacking the facts necessary. They did not exist here. We ask that you uphold the decision of the ALJ and award attorney's fees as requested. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gruska. And thank you, Ms. Timmons. We appreciate your helpful arguments. And this matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much.